I go from recording to a quick lunch to a nap to...
I like how you have your priorities. You got to get that nap in.
Yes. They expect me to stay up late? I bet again while I get a nap.
I appreciated that Foz in Cape Town was like, you know, I need to go back for a quick snooze. That was good.
Sometimes you just need it.
Yeah. I don't know how you wake up within like 30 minutes of... I would just be out. I'd be done. Like, that would cook me.
That would normally be me, except I didn't really fall asleep. I just closed my eyes.
Oh, okay. It was more like I'm thinking about things with my eyes closed. Got it.
I fall on sleep. I don't, like, I set an alarm usually, but I fall on sleep and then it works well.
You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Foz Mamoon, and Seth Miller.
Hello, and welcome to episode 504 of Dots, Lines, and Destinations. I am Stephen Seagraves, joined today by Mr. Foz Mamoon and Seth Miller. Gentlemen, how are you doing?
Doing okay. How are you?
I got coffee. I'm happy.
That would make me miserable.
Is it Stumptown?
No, I don't actually know where this is from. I mean, I make coffee at home, but I don't remember where I bought these. Seth, what do you drink in the morning then?
Water.
Juice?
Occasionally a juice. Today at breakfast, I had an orange juice because we went out and, you know, I'm on the road with family. So we went out for, you know, brunchish breakfast-ish at, you know, eggs and French toast and stuff. And I had an orange juice. Sometimes I have a hot chocolate.
Do you drink tea? Hot tea?
From time to time. Usually it's a vessel for entirely too much sugar or honey.
You really are Jerry Seinfeld.
I mean, there's an underage girl's comment there, or two.
Oh, no.
And then I was trying to get off this. I could get the bat off my shoulder. Sorry.
Oh, man. Let's talk about aviation. This is going to get us in trouble. Qatar is buying 25% of Virgin Australia to help boost some market access. So who doesn't own a part of Virgin Australia now?
Who does? I think the better question is, who does Qatar not own a part of?
Well, that's a good question.
Because remember, Virgin Australia went through the bankruptcy and like is recapitalized and whatever. So it's different
owners. Okay.
But this was just interesting to me, I think, mostly because of the Australia access situation.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Remember that they'd been trying to get access to service in Australia. So has Turkish. There'd been some questionable regulatory rulings about whether they're protectionism of Qantas or, you know, good for the industry or whatever. But like there have been limits placed and they're not, other countries aren't getting access and expansion approved. And so, you know, when I first saw this headline, it read to me a little bit like the Turkish and Indigo deal, where the local, you know, a lot of treaties for air service have a bilateral component, which is like, you know, your country's airlines get X and my country's airlines get Y. And sometimes X equals Y. Sometimes they're, you know, asymmetrical. But, and then we can fly to each other's countries that way. And yep. In this case, you end up with a situation where something like, you know, Qatar has used all of its allocations, but Australia hasn't used all of its. And so Australian airlines, in the general context there, have access to fly to Doha. Well, none really want to or can. But if Qatar can show up with 25% ownership stake in an airline and some spare airplanes and be like, hey, Virgin Australia, congratulations. You have an A350 now. I bet it would look really good serving Doha as a wet lease operation, which is basically what they're looking at. I don't know what type of plane. But, right? There's talk of multiple routes operated as a wet lease. So it'll be a Qatar Airways plane, Virgin Australia, quote-unquote, operating it and selling it, but then with a Qatar code share put back on it. So it's basically Qatar Airways operations. It's an end run around the regulatory rules. And so... you know, I find that amusing. It's, you know, whether you like it or not, it's an interesting way to get around some of these rules. And it sort of shows if you've got the money and a compliant partner, you can break rules sometimes.
I guess there is a ton of demand for Australia. It is bizarre to me that that protectionism of Qantas almost comes off as like protectionism of Australia instead of like basically keeping people from coming to Australia is what it feels like at times.
Yeah, I'm torn on that. I don't know that its demand is so great as of right, like we've seen from North America over and over. The U.S. carriers try to keep throwing capacity at different markets and whether it's because the Qantas sort of domination of the market or just there's not that much demand. They keep trying to grow it and it ends up not going so well, right? They've had to scale back time and again. So I'm not sure how much of it is protecting Australia versus just tried to protect because there's so much demand versus protecting Qantas because there actually isn't that much demand. And if the other guys all show up, these other allies all show up, then it might hurt Qantas because they can't maintain that, you know, fare levels or demand levels or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, so what are the actual rules right now? Is it one destination per carrier? Like, is it?
No, I don't know what the bilateral between Qatar and Australia is.
Yeah, because I was like looking. I mean, like Emirates flies everywhere in Australia.
Yeah,
but they pretty much do it with an A380 everywhere. And then
it's either that or 777 for them. So you know.
Yeah, I mean, they fly one 777, I think. They do two Sydney Dubais back to back with A380s, which is insane.
Like at the same time?
Basically an hour apart.
Wow.
Qatar is doing Sydney to Doha on an A380, Perth to Doha on an A380, and Adelaide to Doha on an A350 currently.
The Adelaide one, the one that has like a tag-on flight to Sydney?
Think it might.
I believe right? so.
That was the one that they were using, again, trying to get, we talked about this like a year ago or something,
yep.
but like they were using that as an end run on the rules. So if you can't fly to Sydney, you have to go somewhere else first.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly. I think that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's, the market seems, I mean, the Emirates and Qatar wouldn't be flying these routes if there wasn't demand, right? And maybe that demand's onward. Maybe that's why.
I'm sure it's onward. There's not that many people going to Doha, but, you know, I think the, how much, you know, is there like 5% additional demand and Qatar wants to add 40% more capacity and it's going to be bad for the existing airlines or whatever. I'm not sure there's enough demand to add that much more in total. Here we go. Qatar confirms that its operations to Australia's main gateways of Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, and Perth are restricted to one daily flight each, 28 total weekly operations, but limited to basically 1x daily to each airport, plus unrestricted capacity to secondary airports, which, yeah. But Emirates is allowed 105. Etihad has 56. Air Arabia, I think it's only 7, but I can't imagine it's actually operating any of those because it doesn't have long-haul planes. So, yeah. And I don't know what the regional package is, but I wonder if that's that allows for, like, onward, like, via a third party, or a third country
yeah.
type thing. Anyway, yeah, it's... Qatar is mad that it has basically way fewer, you know, half as many flights as Etihad and, you know, even a quarter of what Emirates gets.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is a way around that.
We'll see how it goes. Virgin Australia is an odd duck, but we'll see how this goes.
Yeah.
Emirates has some new credit cards.
Yeah, we don't talk about credit cards that often, and I certainly find them annoying as a topic, but this was interesting to me for a couple reasons. So it's a UAE issued card. I imagine we don't have many listeners who live in the UAE, but maybe, you know, for the grass is greener kind of conversation, to understand what the other compelling, what the offerings are in other places. Two premium cards. One comes with like it's an Infinite and a Signature. So they're Visa cards, and Infinite and Signature are just the standard Visa tiers of whatever. $700-ish annual fee for the Infinite and $300 for the Signature. So expensive cards. The fine print on them, though, is super interesting to me. It's sort of what got me intrigued / annoyed the more I kept digging into them. And so it's like you look at points earning and like earn up to 2.75 points for dollar spend. You're like, okay. And it turns out that that's only for spend on Emirates and Fly Dubai and only on the premium card. Typical earning is either 1 point per dollar or 0.75 points per dollar, depending on the premium card or the basic one. Foreign transactions get a bonus. So spending in non-AED is the currency code. I don't know what that is. Emirate dirhams.
Mm-hmm.
If you spend on a foreign currency, you make more, you get earned more points. But if you buy, there's a long list, government services, public transport, utilities, telecoms, education, real estate, fuel, groceries and supermarkets, insurance and auto dealers. All of those earn only either 0.1 points per dollar or 0.25 points per dollar per car.
Well, I mean, we can't have you buying cars and making lots of points from that.
Okay. But, you know, I mean, right. In the U.S., they are, you know, they stop that by just the dealership saying, no, we're not going to pay the discount. You know, we're not going to pay the 3%
yeah.
fee for you to do that. There, they make it just the points are worth, you know, you don't earn as many points. So it's which side you fight that from, I guess, is interesting yeah. to me. But the bold line is no expiration of these points for as long as you have the card. But the fine print is very clear. It's only the points you earn from credit card spend get the no expiry. So points you earn from flying still expire.
Wow.
Or, you know, you earn from anything else still expire. And then you do be a piling on. There's like you get free beach access and free movie tickets if you have this card.
Beach access where?
At like the resorts in Dubai and in what's the other one? Abu Dhabi.
Oh.
Beach access is a thing?
Yeah. Beach club. Like you pay to go to the beach club.
Okay. That's a very New York thing. Like Long Beach, like out on, yeah. I've heard of this, yes. I didn't realize it was a thing in the Emirates. But.
Sure, man. If you can pay for exclusivity, the Emirates will sell that. but what's interesting about that one is, that and they have a free 1 gig global eSIM also from Aerolo. All of those come with a minimum spend, and it's a minimum monthly spend. So you have to have spent $3,000 in the month in order to take advantage of the free beach access. If you don't spend that much money, they charge you.
Wow. So I'm guessing it's like a credit to your card. I'm guessing.
Yeah, I think like you see a 250. It says it's 250 dirhams, which is like $8, I guess, $10. Yeah. But like you'll see the transaction, and then if you hit 10,000 that month, you get it credited back. If not, the transaction holds. I guess it's probably how they do it. But yeah, it's just like the way that they're doing all of these things. It's very much we have benefits, but we have benefits only if you use the card, and that is very different than what we're used to in the United States. I thought it was interesting.
I mean, that's how these guys make money, right? There's a commission off every transaction, so.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. It's just, you know, are we going to start seeing more of this elsewhere?
Don't give Chase any ideas.
Right? Well, this is HSBC. But yeah, right? I wonder. And it's a very different approach. Lounge access also. If you have, they get, you know, two different tiers of lounge access. It's a Visa-specific lounge program. But your first visit is free no matter what, but after that you have to have foreign spend on the card, and it's only $1. Like you just need one foreign transaction, but if you don't have that, you can't use the lounges. The whole thing is weird like that to me.
That is very strange.
So good times.
I mean, was there any, I guess the draw would be if you were doing a lot of international travel or something, this card could pay off maybe.
I mean, I don't know what other options there are for earning Emirates Skywards points. And it has some value for international travel. I'm not sure it's necessarily a big international versus domestic usage, right? Like the very limited earning rates on most of the things I would spend money on in when I'm home, groceries, whatever, makes it questionable value. But if it's 0.1 points versus 0, 0.1 is better than 0, arguably.
Yeah.
It's the whole like the fine print stuff of and how they advertise, like you get all these things and then in very hard, you know, it was weird to come up with like the details buried down about where all the limitations were.
I mean, this kind of comes back to like just overall American credit card usage and differences in how they're sold and marketed here compared to other places in the world. I mean, this definitely points it out, right? Like it compared to Europe even.
Or, yeah, well, it's because merchants pay a lot more to have people be able to use credit cards in the United States than they do elsewhere in the world.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
I would also argue part of that is that the U.S. is much more credit dependent than any other part of the world.
That's fair too. I think there's like the culture around a credit card is much different in the United States than it is in other places. I think that's slowly changing.
I would agree that there's the credit culture here, but I think the premium card points side of it is a different beast. Right? Like those are going to be a much smaller proportion of the people who are carrying a balance and spending all the extra, yeah, you know, like, I don't know. I think it's a different part of the market. The other thing is, though, also to that point, though, strict income limits. We talked about this with the Astana ones a couple weeks ago. Income limits to be able to get the cards rather than a credit score. And I'm a little torn on that. Like, it's a little weird having income limits, like, explicitly defined. If you don't make this much money per month, you can't have our credit card. But also, in a world where you don't necessarily have the insanity of credit scores and the shit show that those are, They do some good things, but they're also pretty terrible in some ways. That was another bit that was interesting to me.
But I would argue, even in the States, right, there is income limit requirements, right? It's not just a credit score.
I have never seen an application that says, if you make less than this many dollars, we will not give you this card.
Well, they won't say that, right? But they ask you for your income, and that'll determine your qualification.
And your credit limit, as much as the issuance of the card. But yeah, it's just, it's the way it's explicitly stated.
I think that's different, right? Calling it out directly.
I think it's just more transparent.
Which I kind of like. Like, don't apply for this if you're this, you know, if you don't make this much money. I kind of like that. I appreciate it. We're going to talk a little bit about more about credit cards, including the CSR changes. We'll do that in the bonus topics. Kind of a random aside, though, on this piece of Emirates credit card stuff is, what do you guys think of there's been a lot of hubbub around U.S. law changing around credit cards and whether or not, you know, those transaction fees and things can continue. Is this much ado about nothing? Or is there actually something going to come from this?
Anything's possible. I mean, I think in some ways, while as much as I love my points earnings, in some ways, I think it's a good thing because it'll curtail a lot of the stupidity around these points earners.
I can't wait until we get tweets from this.
I don't think it'll pass this year anyway. So in this session, so we'll, you know, it doesn't really matter right now. But I think the big challenge to it is sort of the. It's interesting to see A4A, the Airlines for America group, fighting this takes away vacations from your everyman versus the big merchants saying we're going to lower prices, things will get cheaper because we don't have to pay 3% for everything we sell. But the law is basically trying to cap transaction fees.
Yep.
And that those transaction fees are what fund the payout of the flows.
Steven, I don't know if you noticed, but there's a lot of marketing at Dulles around this.
Oh, yeah. Tons. I saw it. I mean, that's the lawmakers, right? So and that's kind of what made me think about it a little bit. So I was thinking about this, like the credit card companies are saying, look, we'll make this the 3% that we have to pay, 4%, whatever it is. We're going to pass that on to customers. If you believe that, I have a bridge to sell you and it's in Arizona. And so, but I feel like this is like, no one should take that at face value. I think there's true benefit. I mean, if you looked at credit card earning reports or whatever after this passed, if it did, they would say, look, we'll look at our stock, our shareholder value went up 3%. I mean, that's amazing. I feel like it's disingenuous for them to say that they would pass that savings along to us. We don't need to get into the politics of it. I think it's a kind of asinine. I hope that there's some logic put behind the law. I do agree with you, Foz. Like, it would help curtail some of the stuff we see. But I think the credit card companies could do that themselves if they really wanted to.
But they don't, right? They're too greedy. So the only way, something else external to that needs to change that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, we've all complained about, how expensive point redemptions are. Like, we've probably seen over 100% increase in most awards in the last 6-7 years.
Yeah.
Lounges are packed to the gills, right? Like, we're due for a correction in this space.
I don't know, man. I thoroughly enjoyed standing around the Cape Town Lounge waiting for a seat. I mean, it's the greatest 15 minutes of my life. Anyway.
I forgot to ask about that last week. Did you get in and Foz was told he had to wait outside?
No, I was behind Foz and I just kind of lingered. I was like, okay. I'm not going to argue with these people.
he let me be the ass.
Oh, man. Let's talk about the FAA's safety review of United. It's over.
And it didn't find anything significant.
So what was the original reason for the investigation?
There were a trio of quote-unquote safety incidents that happened earlier this year were I think there's a nose gear collapse and an engine something, and I don't
the wheel fell off the Osaka flight.
Oh yeah.
It was a couple things. At the end of the day, I look at this, I'm like, the bad news is it slowed down. United couldn't run a new route this summer because they could establish a new station and they couldn't induct a couple new airplanes. So that was bad for the airline. At the same time, if you do a safety investigation like this, you hope that the answer is everything was actually okay and there was a couple freak accidents, not that there's a systemic problem in the operation of the company. So
and it found nothing.
Well, nothing of significance.
Did they find anything?
That was not mentioned.
We wrote a report, but I feel like this was done by an intern. Nothing of significance. By the way, here's all my notes. Should I feel good and safe?
Sure.
Okay.
Did you not before?
I don't know, man. Getting diverted, 8 hours into a flight with 6 hours left. I don't know.
Did they announce the diversion that early?
Yes. It was like five hours. Let's be honest. Because I went back to sleep.
I think it was like 3 or 4 hours because I remember waking up and not being able to go back to sleep after it.
Because you're just like wondering what's going to happen.
Just like, well, no, it's just like, okay, how do we recover from this? That's not what was going to happen. Like, we knew what was going to happen.
Yeah. I mean, so from this United report, though, does like, do we...
I haven't seen a report. All I saw is that it, the statement that it had concluded. I don't know that they've actually published a report.
And there was a... No, it's fine. There was another one of these, right, that was happening. Was it for Southwest? There was another investigation taking
place? I think Southwest got one started a month or two later.
Yeah, because after the incident in Hawaii and Maui, and there were a couple of different things, right, where they landed on taxiways and the Kansas City thing.
And they took off from a closed runway in May.
Yeah. I think if the system is basically forcing the airlines to reexamine what they're doing maybe and correct some things, is that the worst, even if the report doesn't find anything? I don't think that's terrible. It'd be good if the report outlined some recommendations or something, but we'll see. You know,
some of that might just be confidential between the FAA and the...
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I don't think it should be, but... Lebanon's plans for foreign airlines to resume service. How?
Well, you know, in theory, at some point, bombs will stop, but this is just interesting to me because a bunch of foreign airlines canceled flights last week, I guess, when Israel started bombing more aggressively into Lebanon, and they issued a NOTAM. The Lebanese government has issued a NOTAM saying, y'all walked away from your allocated slots and route authorizations. When you're ready to come back again, we'll consider it. Right? They're basically going to make people reapply to be able to serve again.
Well, that's disingenuous, I guess.
It's kind of wild. It's... You could argue, like, if you want to serve us, you have to serve. Like, if you want to operate here, you have to serve. Your goal here is to serve our community, and, you know, that's why you're flying. And so we need that service no matter what. I sort of understand where they're coming from. There's a safety aspect that has to be considered. And if the answer is we're not willing to fly there when we think it's unsafe, that means we can't fly there at all. So be it. I sort of get that, too.
Yeah, fair. I mean, it was probably 10 years ago or more now, there was another Israeli-Lebanon type conflict, a short-lived one, but they actually bombed the Beirut airport.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, it's an actual risk to flight crews and everybody. Passengers.
80 years ago, there was a war, and the U.S. bombed Japan, and one of those bombs blew up last week.
Oh, yeah. It was in, what was the name of the airport?
Miyazaki?
Miyazaki, and it blew up on a taxiway, right?
Yeah, under a taxiway, yeah. Apparently, it's pretty amusing to me. Like, the aviation school next door had a camera pointed over that direction and caught the video of it, which is like a random cutting surveillance camera.
Yeah.
So we have video of it happening. And there's a giant hole, like a pothole in the runway or in the taxiway. It's off to the side, but still, they had to close the runway for a day and repair it.
Wow. That's pretty wild.
Yeah. I mean, not that I think that had happened in the Lebanon situation. It's again, you know, the politics of all of this stuff, there's interesting challenges associated with that and how it comes together.
Well, I sent you guys a note about it's unconfirmed video. Like, I still haven't seen a confirmation that the video is real, but over Iran, I think it was an Emirates flight where someone's like taking video outside of the airplane and it's ballistic missiles being launched, reportedly. And there was no NOTAM issued for the airspace. And the Emirates flight's like, we're just going to turn around. So they were like halfway over Iran and turned around and went back to Dubai. Just wild. So, you know, geopolitical shit impacts real people.
I would support the decision of, oh, looks like there's missiles over there. Maybe we're not going to fly there. I think that's a smart choice.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good idea. Spirit. The news for Spirit isn't good lately.
No.
Has it ever been good, I guess, is the question. I could sense that on Oz's lips. He was about to say that.
The news for them has had good periods, whether the service and product... Actually, I'd like to serve some product various times more than you guys, I know. But, much of their reputation is earned, shall we say. They're now, though, apparently considering reorganization, which is the same bankruptcy.
Yeah. I mean, they're struggling financially, like, hard.
Yeah, and I think some of their bonds that are due early next year or mid next year are selling at like 50 cents on the dollar, which is bad.
Yeah.
But, I don't know. That was just a and not a don't buy the tickets, they're going under kind of situation yet. But there's definitely some concern about what the long term situation is going to be and if they can get their finances sorted.
If they do a reorg, I mean, do we see a situation similar to what's happening at JetBlue where it's this massive reexamination of routes and services and things along those lines?
They cut something like 10% of capacity year over year for December. So that's happening.
Okay. Yep. And I mean, JetBlue's now talking about not having like hot meals on transatlantics. Isn't that for cook, right? And that's a story too. I mean, that's a cost cutting measure.
Yeah.
Would we see something like that with Spirit? I mean, could they cut anything? Or is it...
Well, they have the weird challenge of, like, they also just announced that their big front seat is now a real first-class sort of offering.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, so what... And then they're giving away free drinks there and free snacks, so they can't... They can't cut that right away. Like, they already sell most things. Most of what they can cut is unprofitable flying. Where they were trying to build markets and, you know, attack the legacies or whatever, and they were undercutting terribly on price trying to make it happen. And there's also the like, cool, okay, we can sort of go after that a little bit, but we also have all these planes and not as many as we were going to because a bunch of the GTFs are grounded, but they've got all those planes and they deferred a bunch of orders. Like, it's just, where do you cut and what, and what do you do with some of the fixed cost is hard to back out.
Do you raise fares? I mean, is that a first step, or do you think that cuts it kills part of the market if they do that?
Unfortunately, the latter, right? They're for a significant chunk of their customers, their passengers, the competition is a car or the couch, right? If you're not competing against American and Delta, you're competing against someone who wasn't going to travel.
Yeah.
Oh, I think that's the problem they've gotten themselves into is they went into the major fortress hubs.
And then they've created this market where those people who were going to fly on them from those markets are now stuck with the low price vision. And if they raise prices, they lose those people.
Not just that. The majors are matching.
No.
Right? Like, you went into a market and the dominant carrier is now matching your fares. So when you're the dominant carrier, who are most people going to pick?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Right. I think what they should do is they probably need to exit out of these tier one cities and go back to the tier two and tier three because that's where they excelled.
Yeah.
The challenge there is there enough of those to keep growing? And we live in a world where, especially publicly traded companies, growth is the success, not profit. And so...
Well, I understand that. Shrinking your growth and not going to bankruptcy is better than going to bankruptcy.
Generally speaking, yes, I understand. Yeah. No, I see where you're coming from. I'm just like, you know, have they gone too far and can they still right the ship that way? And then what do you do? Like, okay, fine, we've got our 100 cities we serve, or the 80 we serve that are all small markets. Now what?
Pull a Novello, and instead of Portland, fly Portland South, a.k.a. Salem. Like,
yeah, that works for the year or two when someone else is paying for you to be there.
Well, you
seriously,
know.
That's what they do.
I know. I'm trying to think of two, you know, other cities that are smaller that Spirit could fly to that,
yeah,
you know, make this work. I don't think it's good if we lose a carrier. I don't think that's good for anybody.
Agreed.
I think Foz would argue that it's good for fares to go up a little bit, but I don't know that I completely agree with that view.
Yes, I would, because I think there's just too many people right now.
There's too many people.
There's just too many people at airports.
Now you're Jerry.
Just too many.
So Aer Lingus has announced they're going to start flying to Nashville, Tennessee next summer?
Yep, next summer on the A321XLR. So they finally got that sorted out, and they got plans to induct the new plane, which is... The reason Iberia is the launch customer is because they had... pilot negotiation challenges, and Aer Lingus was supposed to be the launch customer. So that's just good to see that's being sorted.
Yeah. 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 So it's to Dublin. Are they going to do it like every day, or is it three X a week? You didn't do your research. Okay. Got it. It's okay. It's pretty far. It's almost 4,000 miles.
Yeah.
Not terrible, but that's a little bit of a haul.
Yeah. It's going to be 8 hours on a single plane.
Does the XLR, I mean, its range, I need to look it up real quick, XLR range, it's about 4,700 nautical miles. So it's got another 700 miles.
Well, think remember, nautical is way longer than a statute.
I was looking at, I'm looking at statute, sorry. Yeah.
You'll get an extra 10% or something there. But also, rumor has it the XLRs are, at least the early deliveries are going to be like 10% light on that, or 5%, a couple hundred miles shorter than the 4,700 that they've been promised, so.
Really?
Yeah, that both Frontier and JetBlue have officially used that as their statement for why they're currently not taking the XLR, rather than our operations are in a bit of a mess and we can't take on service.
Yeah, because they're going to fly 4,700 nautical miles with their planes.
Right. Okay. It's bullshit. But that's their official statement.
So it can do London to Vancouver. The XLR can.
Barely.
I want to see.
So that's like 4,700 miles, 4,900 miles.
Let's see. Vancouver, Dublin, Vancouver, Heathrow. Vancouver, Heathrow is 4,700 miles, which means it's, let's see, nautical miles. If I put this in nautical.
44. So it probably can't do it westbound in the winter.
Fair. Yeah. It'd struggle. But, I mean, that's pretty wild. We're going to start seeing single aisles to Europe from Middle America.
Do not give anyone ideas.
Oh, man. Iceland Air is chomping at the bit.
Well, Iceland Air could do Vancouver. That's way shorter.
Way shorter.
You say like 1,200 miles there.
Who would really want it? I'm trying to think in Europe. Who would want Welling?
Would want what? The XLR?
Yeah, to serve Europe from the West Coast. Welling. Yeah. Pain. My friend's pain.
You mean physical discomfort, not service to Everett.
Yeah. It's physical discomfort on the airplane because of Welling's 29-inch pitch or whatever it is now these days.
For 8.5 hours?
For 8.5 hours, yeah.
All right. I think we should stop letting you talk about terrible things.
Okay. All right. Anything else you guys want to chat about before we jump to our bonus topics of Bastion, Air China, CSR updates, Shea Sapphire Reserve updates, and Boeing strike updates? Anything else?
I'm done.
All right. Well, listeners, thank you for tuning in. We'll talk to you next time. Be sure to tweet us, leave a comment. We'd like to hear from you. And we'll talk to you in the next show. Happy travels.
Take care. Bye-bye.